Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello and welcome back to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is your host, The Progeny, and I'm also joined by the professor today, and
the patriarch.
Are you ever going to say that right?
I say it right every week, I thought. Do I not? Is that not correct? Patrician?
Patriarch.
Isn't that
I'm the old paterfamilias.
Yep. We're back.
Yeah, we're back. And happy to be here. And we've got a lot to talk about today because we're going to be talking about my favorite book of all time, which is made into one of my favorite movies of all time, but not my complete favorite movie of all time, but definitely one of my favorite topics of all time. And I'm very happy to be talking about it. And the patriarch looks like he's in pain.
I'm just trying to kind of even things out. So where you're so bubbly, I'm going to try to be more curmudgeonly so that everybody out there will have a, you know...
Get off my lawn.
A balance.
Well, you know, normally speaking, I'm a very curmudgeonly person.
Yeah, and,
you know,
that's true.
I really am, especially among people my age. I'm definitely the person telling others to get off my lawn, to shut up about your trigger warnings and your microaggressions, you know. So, yeah,
what's a microaggression?
I wish I didn't have to explain this to you, but we'll have to have the talk later.
Okay.
It's something that doesn't exist.
So, Don Trump has macroaggressions, right?
Yes. That's exactly what he has. The Donald.
And Ben Carson has microaggressions, I guess.
Well, Ben Carson has, whatever the he's just kind of micro in every level. He just approaches things very calmly and methodically, and.
I'll give this out there. I'm going to throw this out to the only now like 15 candidates that are running for president other than Donald. And I'll throw this phrase up there, and whoever grabs it first will single-handedly destroy the Trump machine. And that's when somebody's smart enough to say, you know, Don, you really are putting the rump in Trump.
I think
that's just short and pithy enough to get picked up by like everybody coast to coast, and it'll instantly, you know. Pierce the whole.
No, it won't. Because I think it's like what the Ricochet boys said. The what's going to puncture the Trump effect is when somebody gets ahead of him in the polls, and that person is in the middle of the stage of the next debate.
That's quite possible.
Because he couldn't do that. That would just.
Especially if he moves two or three places. If he starts moving two or three places.
Because then there's like a visual aid, and every time he says, I'm the greatest, you're thinking, no, the polls don't say that.
Yeah, that's not what, yeah, that's a good point.
Because he relies on populist, just, the greater the polls, obviously he has to be a marvelous guy. You know, the more popular, the better. Like Hitler.
Well, Mussolini, more like it.
Yeah, he's kind of got the Mussolini,
What's the word for studying faces?
Physiognomy. Yeah, well, he's got like, oh, the mannerisms, that's what I was looking for. He's got the Mussolini mannerisms there.
Yeah, but you need the, you know, that, if you just read the faces, it would take you a long way.
Yeah, of course, he kind of alters into a completely different person when he's not doing the Mussolini. But you can find a few instances of him doing on camera.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. He doesn't do the motions, he talks like an ordinary human being. He doesn't say, you know, that he's the greatest or anything. He just generally talks like an
ordinary
guy.
You're not talking about the president,
guy.
Right?
No.
Yeah. Just want to make sure. That we had the right narcissist.
The right dictator.
Yeah.
Anyway, right. Since we have lots to talk about, and I have expressed my excitement, because there are a few things that I get excited about, and I'm not embarrassed to get excited about them, because I feel like I have rationed my excitement behind a wall of cynicism for the rest of my life. So I've just kind of let loose here. So, you know, but the patriarch, he doesn't have that outlet. He just sits there.
I sang in, at the end of the last episode.
That's true. That's
I broke into song. It was like living in a musical.
But did you hear yourself sing? You were making fun of the fact that you were singing while you were singing.
I don't know that.
You said, and I think to myself. I know the workings of your mind. The scary thing is we think so similar.
No, that's not true. That
yeah,
is not true.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Isn't that right? That's not how the lyric goes?
Oh, yeah, yeah, well,
I guess not.
Maybe that's...
Daryl appreciated it.
Yeah, you've got a few fans down in the comments.
I might need to, you know...
Speaking of the comments,
cut though, a record.
I think we've got kind of like...
Epic.
The most epically lengthy comment we've ever gotten on a podcast from a friend of mine, Virgil T. Morant. I guess that's how you pronounce your last name. I think it's a marvelous name. Yeah, it's a really interesting comment, it's been kind of a crazy week, so I never did respond to it, partly because I didn't have the time, and partly because by the time I did get around to looking at it, I don't think I really needed to add anything to it. It's just it's a really thorough and just fascinating examination of some of the stuff we were talking about last week, in particular a case about kind of a wrongful birth case, and how all of that works out practically in the legal system, and I'm no lawyer, but just kind of looking at a glimpse into that system is really interesting to me, because I find all of that very very intriguing, how that's going to play out in the future,
well,
with the way that Western society is going.
So now they're gonna, you know, shoot. Bring it before the judge, and the judge will say, bring me a sword and we'll cut the baby in two and solve it that way. And she'll say, so be it.
You know, as it happens, there was a case recently, and I actually wrote a piece about it, and it was about Sofia Vergara, who is an actress, and she and her former husband or boyfriend, I don't remember which, had some embryos that they had, I guess, frozen, and she wanted, and he wanted the judge to pass a law, to do something that would protect those embryos from being destroyed no matter what. You know, she wanted to have possession of the embryos because they were breaking up, him and her, and he was afraid that she would destroy them, and he wanted to have possession of them. So everybody, they were split over this, and everybody was like, well, he just wants to kind of keep on with that relationship. He just wants power over her. And I'm like, look, I mean, one of these partners could possibly kill these embryos. The other partner doesn't want to. I don't care what his motivations are. You know, it's so I actually, basically the substance of the piece I wrote was just to take a clip from that and then to juxtapose it with the story from the Bible. It's just insane. But anyway,
You should go into law.
I don't know. I don't think I could stick out law school, honestly.
Sure.
I mean, it interests me, but just the tedium of just learning the small stuff, the every jot and tittle. I don't think I could do that.
Oh yeah.
I'm too easily distracted.
And you get, you know. You get to make you get to strike fear in the hearts of anybody that crosses your path for the rest of their miserable lives.
And be the butt of everybody's jokes?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. I mean, you could do, you know, The Pilgrim's Podcast, the legal edition.
And we did you talk say legal or illegal?
The legal, and we could talk about cases. You know, your case history. Anyway, moving on. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, this is our forum for discussing what I'm going to do in life. Anyway, so since we've got lots to talk about, we need to get on to that.
That's right.
We're talking about a movie from 2001 called The Fellowship of the Ring. And I'm going to start out with a really sappy question. And
oh,
I'm going to bat this one to you because
God.
I know you love this so much when I do this to you. So, now everybody just imagine, he's on the couch here and I'm like Dr. Phil. What does the Lord of the Rings mean to you? Do you want me to answer that one first?
Yes, why don't you answer that first?
All right, well, let me expand the question to make it a little bit less sappy. Because I knew you were going to love this one. That's why I put it first.
You got to be careful there. You won't get to your other... You're not going to get anywhere near these others.
Podcasts.
You'll spend 20 minutes on this.
We'll do two podcasts then.
Okay.
So, when did you encounter Lord of the Rings first?
I imagine it was in high school, and I'm 50 years old, so, you know, it's been a few years. It's funny because I think the first thing I remember is seeing something somewhere that said, you know, that somebody had scrawled Frodo lives on one of the subways in New York or something, you know. And I remember thinking, what's that about? And then I guess there were the animated features. I'd probably seen The Hobbit, maybe, the Rankin Bass or whatever. And so The Lord of the Rings was this kind of this unknown, big... And you have to remember that I was very poorly read. Didn't have access. I mean, part of it was my fault, but we weren't encouraged to read. We didn't have a lot of access to good literature or you know, that kind of stuff. And my upbringing was a lot more austere, I guess. I mean, it wasn't bad. I'm not complaining at all. But it was rather austere when it came to, you know, any outlets for creativity or really pushing me to think about things or kind of... And so I think I was primed for this escapism type stuff. And then... Somewhere along there, I guess in high school, probably sophomore to junior year, maybe, I got my hands on a copy, probably paperback copies of those. I don't know where, maybe the library, but I doubt it, and started in on those, and really was kind of captivated. I mean, I started, you know, then I found a Tolkien bestiary, or bestiary, whichever how you pronounce it, but... You know, it had all the... It started to fill in all the blanks for this world, you know? And it had this really cool artwork that really drew me in. And then you just started to see the Hildebrandt brothers, I think, that did a bunch of the paintings. And, you know, there were other books about the books. And so I kind of got drawn into that. And really just used it as a way of escape. I mean, that's bottom line. It was just a manner to kind of get me out of, you know, I was a 115-pound weakling, basically, and with really no prospects and nothing to make me exceptional. And
you know how I was saying earlier about that curmudgeon thing?
Well,
I just wanted to point that out.
Am I commerging?
Commerging.
Am I mercudging?
I just think that you're looking at it a bit cynically.
What do you mean by that?
Never mind.
Anyway, you asked me you asked me about that, so that's what I said.
Yeah,
and that's why it was so special. because it was a way to become some, to kind of go somewhere where I, elsewhere.
You could almost call it lies breathed through silver.
Well, I guess you could, but I wouldn't call it.
No, but the professor might. Because he and the author of Lord of the Rings once had a conversation about.
But the, you know, it just kind of filled a gap. It filled a hole at the time. That nothing else was even trying. You know, that, and that included my belief. I mean, my you know, religion just wasn't doing that either, and I wasn't. You could say I wasn't trying, but that's definitely the case.
Well, the way I was going to kind of segue with that was the conversation between Tolkien and Lewis was actually really important to Lewis's conversion, and it has to do with sort of that topic, the idea of myth. And Lewis, he grew up very, very lonely and immersed in books after his mother died, and he was kind of alone in the house, and he would read books, and he would read these myths. And by this time, he had decided he was an atheist. But he read these myths about a great power in the world and the idea that there is great good and evil forces controlling things, or, you know, and the stories of valor and sacrifice. And many of the myths have very, very Christian, kind of pre-Christian themes in them. Many, even pagan myths, many, many pagan myths have the sorts of things that you can look at and say, that's the sort of thing that Christ sort of fulfilled completely. These are sort of echoes or mirrors. And so Lewis, young Lewis, those things really resonated with him, those sort of fantasy stories that he escaped into. He knew they weren't true. He didn't find them to be true. He didn't, you know, so he talked to Tolkien about this. And he said, well, you know, all that's very good, but it's just lies breathed through silver. Tolkien, of course, he was a Catholic, so he was trying to convert Lewis at that point. He argued that was not the full case. He says we have come through God, we have come from God, and inevitably the myths woven by us, though they contain error, will also reflect a splintered fragment of the true light, the eternal truth that is with God. Indeed, only by myth-making, only by becoming a sub-creator and inventing stories, can man aspire to the state of perfection that he knew before the fall. Our myths may be misguided, but they steer, however shakily, towards the true harbor, while materialistic progress leads only to a yawning abyss and the iron crown of the power of evil. You mean, asked Lewis, that the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth that works on us in the same way as the others, but a myth that really happened? In that case, he said, I begin to understand.
Hmm.
And that was, so in a very real sense, that sort of led Lewis to begin to look at the world differently. And in many ways, I think that was the same for me. When I was young, I was very bookish and, you know, and I was lonely, and I would go into these fantasy worlds, and it was a form of escapism for me as well. Not, of course, that I had, you know, too much to escape from. I had a great life, you know. But there were things in those stories that I didn't recognize in the kind of banal everyday workings of my life. Things like nobility and valor and sacrifice. And
yes, agreed.
And something which I could not describe.
Yeah, I agree.
There was some sort of quality about it, which I couldn't name. I couldn't understand, and I couldn't identify. But that quality, I have come to realize, was holiness. There's a tangible sense of the divine in the Lord of the Rings. I was getting ready to say
purity. Just before you said that, I was going to say purity. That things are, you know, what they don't. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with your word.
Well, I think it's both of those things in different ways, and of course,
yeah.
You know, if you look at it from a postmodern viewpoint, like say this marvelous Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky fake audio commentary, which you guys ought to look up. It's hilarious political satire. Then you just tear it apart and say, well, real life is more complicated than this. This is just the way it is. But I think that really is to miss what the story does accomplish. And you're asking it to be what it isn't. Most stories that were written in most of human history were not nuanced and complicated examinations of the human psyche. You know, I mean, this isn't Dostoevsky, and it's not supposed to be. But anyway.
I'd forgotten about that. I mean, I think my, 16, 17 year old self tapped into. I mean, I wanted to do something. I wanted to do something great. You know, I mean, I think most kids do at that age, maybe, hopefully, perhaps.
You know, that was the thing, though. Most of the other kids didn't want to do that. They just wanted to just go to school.
Right.
And, you know, that just made me, and it still frustrates me so much, that people don't aspire to be more than they are. They don't.
Right. And it,
especially around here, anyway.
And, which brings up law school. So, anyway, yeah, like you can do something great there. But what I mean is, anyway, you know my opinion on that.
Yeah, he's just going to do some pop shots at lawyers.
But, that's true. I mean, you could do lawyers. There are many good lawyers, and there are many great things they do. John Adams.
Yeah, John Adams was pretty cool.
I think that's true, is that there's kind of a, you know, I don't know, I think that, or at least I like to think that people have a kernel in them, maybe call it the image of God, that says, I want to do something great. Not necessarily for themselves, not for their own greatness, but in this battle of good versus evil, in this battle of right and wrong, that they want to do, that they you know, want to do something in that. I mean, you think about, in every soldier in every army, right or wrong, I mean, they have tried to do something bigger than themselves, I guess you could say. I hate to use that phrase, but
well, I think you're right. It's that.
They're going to be a part of
something. Especially in modern Western society, there's no outlet for that.
No,
except
there's not.
And generally, the church isn't that outlet because most people.
Agreed.
Because most churches don't frame it in that way.
Right, they don't.
You know, and that's something that resonates with me with our church so much because, and, you know, maybe that doesn't resonate with a lot of the people around here, and I guess that's okay. But just the idea that you're part of a movement that's going to...
No, it's not okay. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean that sort of language appeals to some people more than others, maybe. I don't know. I mean...
I don't know if that's true because, again, look at soldiers. Soldiers fight and die every day for something, to be a part of something great. And if the church were to put it in that context, you know, that this is a battle, you know, this is a spiritual warfare, that this is something that you have to pick up, this banner and move it ahead, which we've been, in my opinion, woefully poor at doing, and I include myself in some of that, but instead the message is like, the message instead of is, have a good family, grow up, have a good family, do good things, go to work, and those things are important. I'm not saying that's not important, and I'm not saying that you can't do the battles in that, but don't settle for that. Don't just say, you know, so that when you see the Planned Parenthood videos, when you see people being marginalized, when you see injustice, you know, that you don't just sit on the sidelines and say, well, there's nothing I can do about it, you know, or instead, I'm going to vote for this guy.
And he'll let him do something about it.
Because I'm on their team. But I'm not going to risk my own self in that battle.
And that's why I hate so much how I feel like the church has designated its cultural representatives to go out and do battle on its behalf.
That's right. I agree.
It's because you have, you know, well, I'm just going to sit here and be a Christian, and Ken Ham will go out and fight my scientific battles, and Kirk Cameron will go out and fight my Hollywood battles, and Mike Huckabee will be my guy in Washington. It's, you know, or whatever, you know, and I'm just kind of picking on those guys because they're you know, Christian conservative leadership, you know. But you're allowed to sit on the sidelines and let those other people go off and fight your battles for you. And that's why there was a line in To Kill a Mockingbird that resonated with me so much.
Sorry.
I thought you'd... Yeah.
Moving on.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah. I was going to say that... okay, so, like, right after the trial, Jim, little boy, is talking to Miss Maudie, who's one of the ladies that lives in their neighborhood, about his father. And she's kind of talking about the community's reaction to just what has happened in their community, and to which was mostly just apathy. And I'm looking up the quote now, but I think I've got it here. She says to Jim, let's see, here we go. I simply want to tell you that there are some men in this world born to do our unpleasant jobs for us. Your father's one of them. Oh, said Jim. Well, don't you OL me, sir, Miss Maudie replied. And then a little bit later, she says, we're so rarely called on to be Christians, but when we are, we've got men like Atticus to go for us.
But I don't know, but the part about rarely calling to be Christians.
Well, she means
that,
in, like, you know, in small towns.
I know.
Safe places, you know.
I know. Yeah, I know what she's saying. I know what she's saying, but...
And that is fast become... The small towns of America are fast becoming less and less and less safe. You know, or at least it's... Christians are becoming more and more and more marginalized. And in recent years, they didn't have to fight to keep the world Christianish or whatever. Or they didn't even really have to get out of their comfort zone to be a Christian. You know, because that was culturally acceptable.
That's true.
But now, it's, you know, whenever you have to take a risk to be a Christian, we put our Atticuses out there for us. So, that idea of a person who was particularly ordinary from a small town, and I've actually got a blog post coming up that links the Hobbiton to Maycomb in To Kill a Mockingbird. It's an ordinary place, and he gets out of this really narrow-minded kind of little community, which is very, very sweet and winsome in its own way, and he takes on that burden to go and actually try and change the world. And it's just an action of incredible courage. And that just inspired me so much when I was a kid. I'm like, I want to be like that. I don't want... When I see that my community is being... is in danger from some threat outside, then I'm going to go and try and save it. You know, that was something that I just aspired to. That you know, and reading some of my ridiculous novels that I wrote when I was about 11 or 12, that was the thing that came through so much, to the point that the characters actually started quoting the Lord of the Rings to each other. I was not the most subtle of teenage writers. That's mostly, I guess, why I've given up writing novels lately. But, yeah, that was just, and that's also a theme in The Lord of the Rings, is that once you step out of your community and step out to do those things, you have stepped into a world that is dangerous, that is but the danger is almost explicitly connected to something divine. Like when they go into Lothlorien, and this is a quote from The Two Towers, which I was reading earlier today. They were talking to Faramir about Lothlorien, and he said, "Is not the Lady of Lothlorien perilous?" And Frodo says, "He says I don't think that she is perilous. He says I think that the danger is brought by those who come from the outside." So, and I think that was an image of the divine, especially the elves and all those sorts of things. That this is a divine power, and once you come into the presence of that, then your own frailty and your own weakness is shown for what it is. And so there are just so many images of the divine in the story. And that's, I guess, you know, I'll jump to this question. Do you find there to be an explicit divine element to the story? Or what is the most explicit form? Hmm. Are any of the characters literally supernatural? Is there ever reference made to a supernatural reality? And there are several different answers to that I want to talk about. One of which is Ian McKellen's. It's a fascinating thing to read Jeffrey Overstreet's interviews with the actors in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, because he asks each of them a kind of a variation on what do you think the story means, and he gets everything from just it's about environmentalism to friendship to Islamic terrorism and how the West is failing and the demography crisis. It's there is one Mark Stein among the group. that's John Rhys-Davies. But Ian McKellen says, "I note with delight that Hobbiton is a community without a church. There is no pope in this story. There's no archbishop. There's no set of beliefs. There's no credo. I think what he's appealing to in human beings is to look inside yourself and to look to your friends and to join a fellowship. They don't join a church or a political organization. Everybody brings to it whatever their individual strengths are. I'd be with Tolkien on that." So, how true do you think his analysis is there?
I don't want to agree with it. I don't know. I'd have to think about that a bit. But I guess on the surface, you know, you can't say that he's not right, because he's right. There is no church, and there is no pope or an archbishop, and there's no set of beliefs. However, there's also no industry, right? Frodo and Bilbo are independently wealthy, right?
Yeah.
They don't.
It just happens.
They employ the gaffer or down here to keep their garden.
Which you've got to admit is a pretty privileged view of the world.
Yeah, but nobody, you know, they don't really talk about, okay, where do the clothes come from? Where do the shoes come from? Where does the glass come from? Where does the metal come from? You know, okay, at least it implies that things are made of metal. Well, to have a metal, you have to have a forge, and to have a forge, you have to have a mine. If you have a mine, you have to have miners.
Well, I think
stuff like that. Yeah.
I think what you're getting at is just the idea that just because they don't have a conversation about a specific thing doesn't mean that its effects aren't there.
Right. That's right.
It's like, you know, you never see the industry,
right,
but you see the effects of it.
Right.
I think that's actually a really good way of describing the way faith is in this story. You never see it itself, but
yes,
it's everywhere.
That's right.
And that agrees with what Tolkien said. He said, "The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision." Another good point, which Jeffrey Overstreet made when responding to Ian McKellen, he said, "You're assuming, though, that Hobbiton is Tolkien's ideal society, this society where nobody really thinks about great matters."
Right.
But that is actually seen as a flaw in the story, to be in this little community. It's very winsome, you know, and that's exactly what it's like living in the South. It's an incredibly winsome and charming community, It's a lot like being in Hobbiton, but it just feels stifling sometimes because people don't aspire to great things.
But I'll take it one step further. That's what it's like being in most churches around here.
Yes.
When you bring up the persecuted church and brothers and sisters in Christ who are being persecuted, and you know their names, and you can show them their faces, there's almost no interest at all. You know, that don't bother me with that. You know, let's talk instead about completely unimportant things that are unrelated to this battle.
Well, let's talk about, you know, whether evolution is true.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not completely unimportant.
Or which version of the Bible?
that's more likely. Yeah, let's argue about the version of the Bible, the color of the carpet. You know, it's the color of the carpet doesn't matter when the whole church is just sitting there waiting for the end to come. There.
I have a respect for the church, and I'm not completely throwing stones because I've been in leadership positions in those churches, and I haven't necessarily, you know, carried that banner forward. But I have been in leadership positions where I've been, you know, leading a group in a Sunday school class, that kind of thing. And just getting a rise out of people, sometimes I would say something just kind of controversial, just to see if they were awake, you know, just to try to get a little movement out there.
I remember when I was a kid how I used to want to, like, just jump up in the pulpit and then drop some hugely controversial piece of doctrine down on them. Like, you know, hey guys, have you remembered that we're all going to hell today or something? Discuss. You know, and, you know, and obviously that's a slightly more, I guess, crude form of what you're talking about. But that, I think the same feeling applies. I wanted somebody to realize the deadly seriousness of what we were talking about in church.
And
this matters.
That's like when I spoke at one of the churches there. Is that, you know, I don't know if you remember that. I read like a couple paragraphs from Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Remember
yeah.
that?
We read. Yeah.
So I kind of dropped that. I mean, right out of the gate, and then I stopped reading. And I looked at him and I said, "Well, have a nice day." And there was some uncomfortable chuckling going on. But I know what you mean. But I think you get that somewhat with Lord of the Rings, is that there's this there's this blissful ignorance that's going on in the Shire, where they're being protected by others that they don't even know or appreciate.
Yeah, and that's literal. The Rangers are actually guarding their borders. And they see
people who have worldly wisdom, in the good sense of the word,
yeah,
as, you know, troublemakers.
Yeah, that's so true.
The Gandalfs are the troublemakers.
You know, you come in wanting to stir people up, wanting to make them, you know, try and make trouble and try and upset the status quo. You know, and that is. But, you know, the genius of Tolkien is that he has the graciousness not to take that community and utterly just pillory it, because it would be so easy to just mock that. But he understands how small towns work so well, you know, because, like, people from big cities, they like to think that small towns are just made up of that sort of ignorance, you know, mm-hmm. of not knowing the world outside. But while they are, at the same time, you have wonderful people. You have people who live in this just kind of sheltered Christian community all their lives, and it yields a different sort of fruit, you know. But at the same time, you know, there is apathy, and that's the danger of being in this situation.
And I don't know if that's really any better in cities.
I think that
maybe a little bit more.
I think it's different. You know, it's like if you're in a city, you're not ignorant to people who are different from you.
Agreed.
But you can you can the edges of your doctrine can be worn away. You know, you can just become one of them. You can despair, or at least I'm kind of just saying. I guess you can go out there into the reality and the darkness of the world and grapple with that, and you can stay at home, or you can go out there. And the danger of going out there is that sometimes you will lose. You will despair and give into the darkness. You know, and that's what happens in the societies outside of Hobbiton. The greatest problem is despair in Denethor and Theoden. They look at the darkness and they see the reality of the darkness and they give up. You know, either you can pretend not to see it, you can stay at home in Hobbiton and put your blinders on, or you can go out there and you can not give up. You can have hope even in the utter teeth of despair.
Yeah, you know,
and
you can fight against against almost all.
And Tolkien, he just shows the utter a complete spectrum of the way people react to that challenge. Yeah, I mean, he does have Hobbiton, but he also just really focuses a lot on how people react to the threat of Mordor, and often their reaction is despair when they do face that. Is despair, but he also shows a middle way, which is the way of hope. And the hope is not built on what you see, because there is, if you look at two hobbits going into a huge evil land to destroy a piece of jewelry, it's absurd. There's no middle-earthly reason for them to maintain hope. It's illogical. And that's the beauty of it, because ultimately that's where the divine does kind of manifest itself. And there's another way of putting this. Tolkien, in one of his letters, I want to read this excerpt. A man who classified himself as an unbeliever, or at best a man of belatedly and dimly dawning religious feeling, he wrote to Tolkien, he says, "You create a world in which some sort of faith seems to be everywhere without a visible source, like light from an invisible lamp. I can only answer, of his own sanity no man can securely judge. If sanctity inhabits his work, or as a pervading light illumines it, then it does not come from him, and neither of you would perceive it in these terms unless it was with you also. Otherwise you would see and feel nothing, or if some other spirit was present, you would be filled with contempt, nausea, and hatred." He was saying that whatever that quality was in his work, he didn't put it there. It sort of filtered in from his own faith.
I believe that.
And he was saying to the man, he said, whatever it is you're sensing it because that is in you as well.
Hmm.
You have that, you know, and he was speaking to an unbeliever. And I've known other people who have read The Lord of the Rings and have been led by that inexplicable longing. And I don't mean to make this out to be something greater than it is, but it really is. It's just an extraordinary work of fiction, easily the best novel of the 20th century, in my opinion.
Yeah, something resonates with people, or some people.
It's the best-selling novel, the second best-selling novel of all time, for a good reason, because I think that is what it is. It just resonates with people on a level they can't understand.
Yeah.
It's
very difficult to express it. And I don't know if it's because it all is so elaborate. I mean, that's part of it. It's so well written and well crafted, and it's well paced and all those good things. I mean, it's just a good read. It's just a fun read. But
I wouldn't say pacing was its strong suit, actually.
Well, I mean,
you get the Council of Elrond.
I like that. Now the Treebeard stuff seemed to run on a little bit, but what I mean is the chapters are relatively short, right? So you can sit down and read a chapter a night, or you know, whatever, and stay with it and keep things going, and you know, it's not one of your Russian things.
Yeah, and that's something we didn't mention, was that the patriarch read the book to all of us kids, you know.
Tried anyway.
Well, yeah, I think you read at least The Fellowship of the Ring to me. Well,
yeah.
No, okay. Wait a minute. You read The Hobbit to me, and then you read The Lord of the Rings to Sam and Sarah.
Yeah.
But I still remember your voice because I always hear Tom Bombadil in your voice.
Tom Bombadil.
There's that nostalgia for me too, just being a little kid and having that read to me. But yeah, you know, so
Tom Bombadil.
I guess we ought to move on to like maybe one of these other questions. The Ring. That's sort of the driving force in the story. What does it represent? You know, well, at least now I don't think Tolkien meant for it to represent one thing, so there's no wrong answer to this. But for you, what's the most obvious answer?
Right. I mean, that's the short answer.
So, okay, well, like what sort of power? Power over, you know.
I don't know. I maybe power over oneself or power over I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, it
I think it can be summarized by saying that it's a whole worldview of power being used in a destructive and selfish manner.
Yeah.
To use up natural resources in a way which is selfish. And because you notice that I asked my brother, I also asked Tacitus, and they had a very similar answer, why Sauron was the bad guy in the story. And he kind of paused a minute and looked into the distance, and then he said, you know, he says, I think Sauron's the good guy. He's trying to kind of industrialize Middle Earth, and they're a bunch of kind of wimpy tree huggers that are trying to stop him. And I said, Tacitus, that answer is so you. It's just so you. And he's like, yeah, they're a bunch of hippies. They just want to, you know, take care of the ants and all that sort of stuff. You know, they're probably French.
I think that's the, you know, and there's a grain of truth there about the industrial aspect of our world is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, don't get me wrong, clean water and you know, many of the advancements are just wonderful, but, you know, I mean, we throw away so much stuff, and I'm not talking about necessarily just food, which is bad enough, but we just plow back into the ground so much plastic, so much metal, and so much paper. We take our trash off, you know, once a week or once every 2 weeks, and it's just so much stuff. And all of that stuff was manufactured and printed and shipped and reworked, and you know, there's just tons of people that are moving products to get those things in place. And I remember thinking the if I were a hardcore environmentalist, I think my perfect commercial for environmentalism would be, you know, showing this pristine forest and these loggers coming through and cutting them down and the logs being transported across, you know, these big trucks, and then they go into the mill and they're reworked, you know, they're worked down into smaller products or sawdust or whatever it might be, and then it goes, is gets shipped off to the paper mill, and then the paper mill, you know, they take all these, if you've ever been in a paper mill, it's just an enormous operation, and then it gets cut into smaller pieces, and then it gets shipped to the printer, and they start printing stuff on it, and they, you know, fold it up, and they put a stamp on it, and then it goes in the mail, and the mail goes across the country, and you know, and it's hundreds of tons of this mail going out, and it's going to this guy's house, and finally makes his way to his hands, and he looks at it and tosses it in the trash, right, as a piece of junk mail. Now that happens to me literally every day, and I think it's kind of a sad commentary. I'm not saying that it's illegal or that it's, you know, not the right thing to do, or you know.
Well, we all know what sort of a tree hugger hippie you are.
Yeah, but there is an argument there that now it's going to go into a plastic trash bag and go and be put in a landfill somewhere where it will never decay. You know, it will not. I mean, unless air and water and gets to it, it will not decay. And so, I just don't see the point.
I don't think that it's immoral to cut down trees. But I think that the argument that Tolkien is trying to make, which was kind of furthered by his environmentalist fans back in, I guess, the 60s and 70s, was that there are two different ways of looking at the world, or three different ways. You know, we talked about the three different ways of looking at hope. You know, you either have blindly ignore the reality of the world, to despair at the reality of the world, or to hope despite the reality of the world. And this is the same case. You can either just not touch nature and just let nature run wild, like many environmentalists seem to want to do, or you can have a more healthy stewardship of nature.
Yeah.
You can respect it and you can value it. And not use it like it's something that is just as if we own it, you know, because that on some level God does own this earth, you know, and we are taking care of that, and we need to respect that, or we can just kind of destroy and hack our way through it. And Sauron is the latter, you know, and that's the implicit assumption there is Sauron is acting as if he owns the earth, as if he has that power and authority to abuse this good green earth, good creation, that has, you know. And that's basically why Sauron is the bad guy, is that all of the way he approaches everything, and the ring symbolizes this more than anything, is to increase his own power and to make himself master of the world. The ring allows you to do that. And it gives you power over the one thing that God uses to prevent men from to keep men from eternal life, death.
Right.
The ring is a way to try and artificially conquer death without Christ. And that's kind of reading into it a little bit, but it really fits into the whole broad sweep of the way Sauron sees the world. The ring grants immortality without appealing to any power except for yourself. You know, it's just eternal. It's a shadow of eternal life. And it's not pleasant. You begin to turn into a wraith. You begin to just kind of waste away. And every day, you know, how does Arwen put it? Just a kind of a living nightmare, because you are so committed to your own power, to living forever, which is itself, you know, a denial of God's sovereignty over your lifespan. You know, you're so committed to that it becomes a pain. You know, and all the characters who are trying to escape death end up facing that. Théoden, you know, he's staying behind in safety. Grima Wormtongue is telling him, you need to be safe, you need to stay here, you don't need to go out there with those crazy wizard people and kick butt. And he says, if you go, you will be killed. And he was right. He went out there and he was killed. But he went out there and he says, I can look into my father's faces and not be ashamed. The point is not to live forever, you know.
Right.
You know, the point is to live well.
I agree.
And that's Tolkien's vision of reality too, is that we don't need to keep that grip on our lives. We need to let go and to do what is right.
To
take risks.
Yeah, I see that so much in our society. I think is that this infatuation with living longer.
Yeah.
and, you know, with almost complete disregard or even thought about what that means or what that entails. And
we just assume that physically living longer will be a better life.
Yeah, is the right thing to do.
Yeah, you know, Theoden really ought to have stayed with Wormtongue, because he would have had a longer life.
Yeah, I can add 15 years to my life, but what am I doing with that?
Like Manasseh.
Yeah, we don't talk about.
Or not Manasseh, Asa, I think.
Well, we don't talk about what you know. You just said you just use the words living well. Well, okay, what are you going to do with those 15 years? What are you going to do with it that's going to redeem that time? And there's no answer for that. Oh, well, I'll just live longer. You know, I'll enjoy my life more.
It's as if the purpose of life is that we enjoy it.
Yeah, that I'll be with my family more, you know. And you know, I just don't think that's enough. That's not enough.
Yeah, and that was another thing that I think just inspired me so much, was this idea that, you know, we shouldn't remain shackled to that safety. I mean, we really want to be safe, because to die is to surrender ourselves into God's control completely.
True, that's right. And just for the record, I have a chainsaw, and I really like to use it.
He just wanted to make sure to reinstate his non-environmentalist credentials.
I mean, you know what? Just very, very brief. Is that there's a wooded area there near our entrance. And, you know, a couple years ago there at Christmas, I had the week off, and I go down there with my chainsaw, and I just had a ball. And it looked, you know, and I cleared out all this underbrush, and I cut down these scraggly, ugly trees, and, you know, left the more healthy ones that are more straight, and was able to trim, you know, dead limbs up and do brush piles. And it was kind of putting an order into the natural way of things, you know. I mean, I was using those tools, the chainsaw and the petroleum and all the stuff that comes from, and my own faculties, whatever you call it, and was trying to bring some order into disorder. I just don't know. I think it's cool.
Well, you realize that what you were doing by taking kind of unshaped, unformed matter and then trying to rearrange it in a way that is orderly and meaningful, you were doing what the Lord of the cosmos did,
right,
when he created the entire universe.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that it's so important that we remember the importance of menial tasks. You know, janitors do that too. When you bring order out of chaos. You know, every task is kingdom business.
Yeah.
Everything. You know, and just the smallest thing is important. And that's another thing that I love about the Lord of the Rings, is that it exalts the humble. It takes the most ordinary of beings and the most ordinary of human actions. You know, the Samwise Gamgee is the hero of the story, Tolkien said, and he never really does. His most heroic moments are generally just in doing ordinary things, like fixing Frodo a chicken dinner. Or just being there, you know, just having his rope and having his. He's no melodramatic heroic figure. He probably would.
Killing giant spiders, stuff like that.
Yeah, he occasionally does that sort of thing. But it's ultimately his decision to carry Frodo up a mountain. You know, it's just an extraordinary elevation of a very humble and ordinary person who never becomes. He never speaks in fancy language, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the ring's effect on him, though, too, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember a lot about it.
It tries to corrupt him in a different way, and because he desires small things, so it it kind of shows him the whole world made into a garden.
Yeah.
I believe. And that, of course, implies the idea that he would be the gardener, that it would be a world in which he would be kind of the god of this garden. You know, that, and that's the same sort of temptation that the ring has. And that's why the ring is evil. And that's a very theological theme.
And that's why there's only one Lord of the Rings.
Yes. If you use it, then you will become him.
Yeah, because you don't own it.
Yeah.
You know, this is borrowed power that you really don't own.
Yeah, and it's that's a theme that runs throughout even the history of Middle Earth that isn't in the Lord of the Rings. That's why Numenor fell. Is Numenoreans were trying to find eternal life, and they rebelled against God. And this was back in the days when they actually explicitly talked about God because they don't talk about God in the Lord of the Rings, but they do talk about him in the other book, The Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk about that, and they were trying to find a way to find eternal life, and that they employed Sauron as kind of an evil priest to do that, kind of a Satanist temple, and because of that, God drowned Numenor. He sent it to the bottom of the ocean, but a remnant survived, and that remnant went to Gondor and became the kingdom of Gondor.
Right.
And that was, they survived, but Gondor eventually fell for the same reason. The line of Anarion was so obsessed with trying to live forever, and then of course you get Denethor, and it just kind of goes in circles and circles. But there is hope. There is that remnant that escapes from the disaster.
Interesting.
So anyway, we didn't even get through like half of the stuff that I wanted to talk about, but this has been fun. I don't know, you know, what are we gonna do next week? Maybe we'll just talk more stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we might just talk about like the three books while talking about themes throughout them, and not necessarily talking about an individual book in each one, but kind of jumping around in it, because we've talked about Two Towers and Return of the King and To Kill a Mockingbird, which is it's actually the unofficial fourth member.
And we didn't talk about your movies.
We didn't even talk about the movies, no. But you know, maybe we could talk about that next week or something.
Maybe we can get Peter Jackson on the show.
Yeah, we can, because we can come in and talk about how we both loved the Hobbit trilogy so much.
Hmm. That's right.
He would never be on the show again.
But
then, even if he was on here and we were nice to him, he would never be on
the
show.
I'd like to talk to him about his King Kong movie. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't think I saw that.
That was cool. Very good.
We'll have to watch that sometime.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do a podcast on it. In the meantime, I guess we better wrap this up, because it's late. But this has been fun, because I love to talk about Lord of the Rings, and anybody that knows me, I was the Lord of the Rings kid in high school.
L-O-T-R.
Amusingly, of course, you were the Lord of the Rings kid in high school, too. So,
I was, yes.
You know, it's kind of a family curse, I guess. Yeah, you can find us online at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. You can send us mail there. Though it might be a while before I read it, because nobody ever sends us mail there. And you can leave a comment on our blog where I will read it and respond as soon as I can, possibly in the form of the podcast, possibly in the comments. We love to hear back from people. You can follow us on Twitter individually or at the Pilgrims Podcast account. We're on Facebook. And I think that's pretty much wraps it up, our social media army.
Right.
Yeah, you know. And
so I need to run on the Lord of the Rings ticket, maybe.
Yeah, you could. The enemy is Sauron.
That's right.
Trump.
Well,
yeah.
So, he's more like Wormtongue, and then we all know who will anyway.
He's more interesting. He's a little bit more brash than Wormtongue. Slightly so.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he has kind of more of a presence than Sauron, though. I think Boromir. I think we'd go with Boromir, kind of somebody who talks big and talks about how, you know, he's the toughest and the greatest, and Gondor is great, aren't they? And he's going to make Gondor great again. And he loves the sword for its brightness and the arrow for its swiftness.
You got
to stop,
or you're going to ruin the whole thing for me. I'll never be able to see it again.
Yeah, and you know, Boromir, he looks at Aragorn, he's like, look at that face. Is that the face of a king? I mean, he's just a ranger.
Yep.
Okay, in the meantime...
thanks for joining us.
We'll see you next week. Namarie.